Welcome to episode 11 of the Elevate Podcast. I am Ben Gideon.
And I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
Rahul, can you believe we're up to 11 episodes?
No, I actually can't, but this has been such a fun ride, and I know it's just the beginning.
Yeah,
hey,
it's
Ben,
been great. Yeah.
This was a special week for you. Hitting a milestone, the big 5-0. Oh, happy birthday.
Thank you. Yeah, it's half a century. It's kind of amazing.
You don't look a day over like 49 to me.
Yeah.
So,
well, it's the low stress job I have. So you had a nice run too. You just got back from Spain. How did that go?
Oh, it's fantastic. We went there. Everybody's super responsible. Thank goodness. It wasn't too crowded and had a relatively speaking uneventful trip, but it was super warm, good beach weather, sites were empty. So I'm so glad we did it. I'm so glad we're home too.
And the kids had fun?
For the most part, you know, on the beaches they did, and they complained at every single site we were at.
Today's Elevate Podcast is brought to you by the Expert Institute. I've been talking a lot about how we use Expert Institute to find experts for our cases, and that's a great service they provide. But I want to talk for a minute about other ways in which we're able to use Expert Institute that goes beyond just locating experts. One of the great services that Expert Institute provides is that it has a whole team of in-house experts that are there to consult with us about our cases, even if we already have experts or we haven't yet located experts to work on the case. For example, if I have a case where I'm not really sure whether to move forward on it or not, and it requires an answer to a specific medical question, I can send it off to the Expert Institute. They can find an expert in the right medical subspecialty, and then I can get on the phone with them to talk through the case and get their feedback about it without having to go out and hire an expert just to conduct a case review. That saves me time, it saves me money, and ultimately it allows me to make better choices about the cases I take and move forward. And if there's a case that I'm not going to take, I'm able to tell my client that I had it reviewed by a doctor before we decided that we couldn't help them. So it's a great additional service beyond just expert location that Expert Institute provides. If you're interested in working with them, I would suggest that you check them out on the website at Expert Institute. If you go to expertinstitute.com/elevate, ELAWVATE, you can get a 25% off discount for your first expert consult. Our show today is also brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is a robust database program used for case management. We manage our entire practice with Smart Advocate, everything from intake all the way through closing and distribution of funds in the case is managed through Smart Advocate. It's got great systems for shortcutting the entry of information, which saves your staff time and makes it more productive. It's generates thousands of letters, email templates. We text our clients directly from Smart Advocate. We use their version of a DocuSign system to have our clients sign all of the important paperwork electronically, saving us a lot of time. So it's really been a great program for us, great system. It's all cloud-based. At least the version we use is cloud-based, which we really like. Encourage you to check them out if you need case management software at smartadvocate.com. And our show is also being brought to you by Hype Legal. That's a full-service digital marketing and web design firm. They do terrific work. They designed all of our graphics for the Elevate podcast. They just launched the company less than a year ago, but have already launched marketing campaigns and websites for a whole bunch of successful law firms. You can check them out at their site, Hype Legal, HypeLegal.com.
This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Welcome to episode 11 of the Elevate Podcast. I'm Ben Gideon.
And I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
And we're thrilled today to have on the show Lloyd Bell. Lloyd is the owner and lead trial lawyer at the Bell Law Firm in Atlanta, Georgia. Lloyd has tried 75 cases or more to juries, including some very high verdicts, particularly in some medical malpractice cases, including one landmark case where he got a $26 million verdict in Georgia, one of the highest medical malpractice verdicts in that state. He's also a frequent speaker at trial lawyer organizations around the country and has really known for expertise on technology in the courtroom. So welcome, Lloyd.
Thank you, Ben. I appreciate that nice introduction, and it's great to be with you. So this is, I've been listening to your podcast since the beginning, and it's a real pleasure to be a guest today. So thank you for having me.
So Lloyd, could you take us back to the beginning and the origins of your career as a trial lawyer? I know you were in the military. You had a kind of a different road to the place where we all find ourselves in many. So could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So sort of a circuitous route, but I went to a military school for undergraduate program, and I was in the Army ROTC, planning on going into the military for a period of time, and I decided I wanted to go to law school. So I got out of the, when I graduated, I got commissioned in military intelligence, but I told the Army folks that I really want to go to law school. And they said, well, that's fine, but you're going to owe us some years when you get out of law school. And I said, well, that's fine, because I'll have a job. So I got out of, finished college, went to law school down here in Georgia at Mercer University, and I got what's called an educational delay. And then when I finished law school, I went to the Army. And this was, my timing was pretty good, because this was the same period of time where A Few Good Men came out, that movie with Demi Moore and Tom Cruise. So of course,
one of my favorites, by the way.
Oh, it's
love that movie.
One of the best ever. You know, I want the truth. But so that really put JAG on the map. And so if people said, what do you do? I just say, you know, you've seen A Few Good Men. It's just like that. Not exactly, but that's how I started my career. So I started in the JAG Corps, and I was stationed at Fort Benning, where I did, I represented the government. I was a prosecutor, and spent a lot of time with the different military units, helping the command and frankly, prosecuting soldiers who got in trouble. And that was my first experience with the courtroom outside of law school. And I just loved it, loved everything about it. I loved the preparation. I loved the process, and felt like that's really where I belonged. So I spent several years at Fort Benning. Then I went to Fort Lewis, Washington. I was a criminal defense lawyer at this point, which is sort of a promotion, the way the Army works. They won't let you represent people accused of crimes unless you have experience as a prosecutor first, which I think is a great model. And when I went out to Washington State, I started representing soldiers accused of all kinds of crimes, the whole gamut. And spent more time in the courtroom and sort of learned something about myself. I learned that I really enjoy going up against the odds. I really enjoy representing the underdog. And it's a lot harder, but there's a lot more room for creativity. In fact, you need creativity in the military, because it's a very tough system to defend soldiers. But I enjoyed it, and that's how I sort of got attracted to trial work. And then when I got out of the Army after several years, I came back to Georgia, and I went to work for some big law firms doing mostly defense work, and just realized this was not for me. And about 21 years ago, I started my own law firm doing nothing but representing people who had been seriously injured. And that practice evolved over the years into a medical malpractice sort of specialty area. And that's what I do today.
So can you tell us just a little bit more about those military trials? I understand, well, from watching A Few Good Men, that there are juries, but they're not like the juries we see when we do regular civil or criminal trials in a civilian setting. And so what are they like? And do you think there are lessons from the trials you did there that translate to regular civilian juries?
There are definitely lessons learned. In a lot of ways, it's a very different environment. In the military, you have what are known as courts martial, and they're military trials presided over by a military judge. But the jurors are not exactly jurors of your peers. And oftentimes represent junior enlisted soldiers, privates, first class, for example, or corporal. But the jury in the military is comprised of senior officers and senior non-commissioned officers. In other words, a lot of people with a lot of stripes on their arms and a lot of medals on their chest. And they just reek of establishment. So you have a young soldier you're representing who might be accused of a barracks theft or some type of assault or whatever. It's a very scary environment to be in because you look up at all the brass glistening at you, and you worry that you're not really going to necessarily be talking to your peers. So that's one of the major differences that I saw, is that it's a very more, especially on the defense side, it's a much more challenging environment in some respects.
So how does that transfer into your practice in civil litigation, Lloyd? Communicating to jurors or the audience and trier of fact who are the establishment, did that teach you about or prepare you for some sort of communication to non-establishment jurors or jurors, at least in the non-military community?
It certainly did. I mean, there were some really important lessons I learned from the from trying cases in the JAG Corps that translated into the civilian world. One of the big ones is that you have to meet your jurors where they live. And what I mean by that is you have to meet them where their value system is intact and where they live in their value system. So if you're representing a young soldier and you have all of these officers and senior enlisted, well, what is their value system? Are they really going to identify with this young, arguably this young screw up who stole from his buddy, which in the military is a crime almost worse than murder? I'm exaggerating, but it's taken very, very seriously because so many people live in close quarters and barracks thievery is reviled. So that's a very serious crime. But how do you get a military jury to connect with a soldier accused of that type of a crime? Well, what I learned through trial and error and also from learning from more senior officers and a military judge mentor that I was fortunate to have early in my career, what I learned is that you don't push against those values. And you don't try to convince the jury that their values are wrong or that they should somehow adopt new values. What I learned to do is to position my case to bring it into alignment with the values of the jury. So what do I mean by that? So if I have a young soldier, well, the values the jury is going to connect with are the values of things such as leadership and integrity and sort of a noblesse oblige that they teach officers. One example of that is when you're out in the field with a military unit, and I spent a good deal of time out in the field with soldiers, which was a great experience. When you're out in the field, one custom that's been around since the very beginning of our country is that officers do not eat before enlisted in the chow line. So when the food's ready and everybody's ready to eat, the officers always let the enlisted go first. It's just an example of leading by example and integrity that helps, builds the unit. Same concept I brought into the courtroom, that I tried to appeal to those values of leadership. So instead of punishing the soldier for making a bad mistake, recognize him as a young soldier, impulse control issues, not a fully formed brain yet as a young man or a young person. So let's lead that person. Let's lead by example. Let's have a punishment or a result that's fair, but don't crush him. That's not what we do as leaders. I learned in the military to speak to the jury in terms of we and us. And conceptually, I've adopted this model that I am on the jury with the jury. I view myself and by extension, my client as part of that jury. And it's a sort of a strange mindset, but it works for me. And I go to court before trial starts. I'll sit in the jury box and I'll try to imagine what it feels like to be a juror. And I carry that through to trials. And I learned how to do that in the military. And I think that's been very helpful and beneficial in the civilian world.
And just to follow up on that, I think you've participated some in the Trial Lawyers College community. Is that approach of envisioning yourself on the jury or talking about we and us, is that something advocated through Trial Lawyers College or sort of that psychodrama approach to trying cases that they, I guess, sort of have advocated for?
I think it's a part of it, absolutely. There's so many great programs to help trial lawyers develop their skills and develop their knowledge base. And Jerry Spence, one of the great trial lawyers of all time, if not the greatest trial lawyer of all time, started the Trial Lawyers College years ago and brought this method of, and to sort of boil it down, is this idea of knowing yourself so that you can know your client and tell your client's authentic story in an authentic way. So a lot of the effort from Trial Lawyers College is spent in getting in touch with your feelings, getting in touch with your individual personality. And some, you know, there's good stuff and bad stuff in that for all of us. And we all have our, you know, we all have our barriers to being better people and better lawyers. Close friend of mine that I've known literally since sixth grade, a friend of mine named Render Freeman, gave a quote one time and I've just adopted it. It's that, working to be a better trial lawyer is the same thing as working to be a better human being. And that's a lesson from Trial Lawyers College, that it's one and the same. I'm not a trial lawyer when I come to work and then I hang up my trial lawyer hat when I go home. The work to be a better trial lawyer, which Trial Lawyers College teaches, is the work to be a better human being, to listen, empathetic listening, understanding, deeper understanding, a lot of self-work to work on your own shortcomings, which we, of course, we all have. So I would recommend that program to any trial lawyer coming up because it really had really helped me in a lot of ways, I think, to be a more effective advocate.
Just following up on the way you communicate in a military case and how that translated into your practice, I've heard of two different approaches people have in trying to develop their themes in trials. One is to identify the universal truths and that paradigm that where it doesn't matter who your audience is, they're all going to agree with these concepts. And the other is what you touched upon, which is developing your themes based on your audience and kind of going and relating to their belief systems. Which way do you lean and why?
Well, I think I adopt a little bit of both of that. I don't think they're mutually exclusive. People sitting on the jury who have their value system believe these are universal truths. I mean, if you, I don't want to get political, but if you go to any political, listen to any political rally, the belief system that people bring, they believe that these are universal truths, whatever they might be. So we're very intentional about creating our messaging using focus jurors to make sure we're on track to test our theories, to test our frameworks and our heuristics, they call it sometimes, but basically our theming and underlying message of the case. There's a lot of great lawyers who are doing a lot of work on in this area of persuasion because the data, and this has been my personal experience, bears out that when you're speaking to people about whatever your facts and your story are, what people are really doing is they're taking in the story that you're offering. They are internalizing it and reorganizing it and telling themselves a story. So I don't see myself as my role as a lawyer as trying to get somebody to buy my story. What I'm trying to do is help them see their own personal story through my client. So my client, and that gets back to that concept of that we are part of the jury. We're all in this thing together. So no matter what my client, you know, looks like, you know, what race, what background, all those sort of superficial things, I talk about my client in terms of a neighbor. She is our neighbor. You know, this is how, you know, in this community where we live, where we're all neighbors working together, I try to bring that concept of community and then access our common community values. So when the jury is taking hopefully strong, bold action to hold the defense responsible and to compensate my client, they see her as an extension of themselves and what they would want to be done if they, you know, had the misfortune of being a plaintiff in a medical malpractice suit.
Can you maybe give us an example, a practical example of how you've done that?
Sure. So I tried a case several years ago. I think you were nice enough to mention it in my introduction. It was a case down in Columbus, Georgia, of a local, beautiful woman who had neck surgery. She had a neck fusion surgery, developed a post-surgical complication. She developed this large blood clot known as a hematoma in the front of her neck. Very dangerous because these things can expand and cause swelling and squeeze off your windpipe and suffocate you and cause brain damage and death if you lose your airway long enough. So she was a pillar of her community. She was a member of her church. She sang in the choir. She was in a four-woman singing group that would go around to nursing homes and to for free and just to sing and perform and cheer up residents, that type of thing. Just that kind of person. Her name was Sandy Williams, and still a very close friend to this day. Wonderful lady. Anyway, so we end up in front of a jury, and through voir dire, we were able to learn a lot about the jurors. And we had some prior military, because Columbus is where Fort Benning is located, a lot of military retirees down there. And we had a lot of church-going people. This is the Bible Belt, of course, Georgia, rural Georgia. So the values that Sandy lived, her values of going to church, of service, of singing in the choir, of volunteerism, we brought those themes out in voir dire to try to identify people who particularly connected with those values. And then, of course, we got a jury full of people who lived with those particular values. So now they're seeing Sandy. I mean, when I talk about, you know, their faith tradition or their work in volunteerism, you know, I would gesture towards Sandy and bring her into that conversation. So the message was, you know, she is one of us, and she is, and by extension, she's a person of value who's entitled to respect, who's entitled to justice in this setting. So that's one example. That was an easier example, easier to pull off in trial because she had so many of those qualities. Every client doesn't necessarily, you know, make it as easy for you. So sometimes you have to be more creative, and you might have a person of a different faith. You might have a person who's, you know, who doesn't look anything like the jury on the outside. So for those people, you try to find the values of family, maybe. You know, maybe they are close to a relative they take care of. Whatever that value system is, I try to identify to my client. I try to connect it with the values of the jury and present the case in that model. And it's been successful.
Just looking at your practice over the last 21 years, Lloyd, how has it changed, and how did you transition into being one of the top medical malpractice lawyers, not just in the state, but in the country?
A lot of hard experience, a lot of mistakes along the way, a lot of searching for my authentic voice. I mean, you're starting off in this business, it's hard to know what your voice is in trial because it's such an unnatural, you know, place to be for most people, including me. I mean, do you model yourself after what you see on TV? Sort of bombastic and aggressive. You know, you're trying to tear people down on cross-examination and build yourself up. I mean, what is your voice? And I had a real turning point, I don't know how many years ago it's been, but I was doing a lot of different types of liability cases and a lot of car wreck cases. And I was not getting the results, consistent results that I felt like the case warranted. And I talked with a court reporter after one of my trials, and it was a trial that nobody could lose. It was a rear end collision, a lot of property damage, some decent medicals, you know, for the type of case. It just looked like an unlosable case. Well, I lost it. It was a defense verdict, and I could not figure out why. And I talked to the court reporter afterwards, and she told me, she goes, "We really came off like a jerk." And she was, I was taken aback, and I said, "Well, what do you mean?" She said, "Well, you talk down to people, you're too aggressive on cross-examination." And she says, "You're just a lot nicer person than that." So I internalized that, and I had my next trial. It was actually in the same county, north of Georgia, north of Atlanta. And I just was determined that I was going to just be on my best behavior and just act like I would act, you know, I would just be myself, hopefully, and be polite to everybody and not let anybody get under my skin. And we tried this case. It was an interesting case it was another serious motor vehicle case. But what I remember and sort of laugh about now is that we showed up for the first day of trial, and the defendant who owned the box truck company that caused the wreck, the defendant showed up in his running shorts and first day of trial. And the look on his defense lawyer's face was one I will carry with me because it was priceless. He just looked at him and didn't know what to say. But he told him to go home and change after lunch. But the defendant sat there in court in his jogging shorts and tennis shoes and T-shirt. But the piece that stands out the most is on cross-examination of the defendant in that case. He's really obnoxious, and he was trying to get under my skin, and he kept using my first name when I would ask him a question. He would start answering. So I'd say, well, you know, isn't it true that 5 trucks that drive around the community, whatever the question was, he'd be like, well, Lloyd, he called me Lloyd. He goes, well, Lloyd, you know, that's not true. We all know what you're trying to do. And he'd look over at the jury with kind of a knowing look. And he'd say, we know you're just trying to trick the jury. I mean, just really obnoxious things. And I can't control when I get upset or embarrassed, my skin just goes red. My ears turn red. My face gets flushed. I just can't hide it at all. I don't have any kind of poker face for that kind of thing. But I was determined to not rise to the occasion, not lash out at him or beat him down or you call me Mr. Bell, you know, that kind of thing. I just ignored it and kept moving on with my questions. So the trial ended. We got a good verdict. Jury wanted to talk afterwards. And this lady walked up to me and she said, we knew that you just wanted to, you know, kill that witness. And just, he was being so rude to you. We were all just waiting for you to tear him apart. And you never did. And we were so impressed that you kept your poise. And of course, defense would say, well, the jury ended up tearing him apart with their verdict based on the evidence, of course. So anyway, that really drove home the point that the best place to live in court as a trial lawyer is calm, sincere, earnest, but really I try to stay centered and not get angry, not get hot, not try to be a bully, just try to stay within my lane. And I just know that's a better approach for me.
So we're going to take a 60-second break now. We'll be right back with more of Lloyd Bell.
I want to take a break for a second to thank our sponsors, Smart Advocate, case management software that personal injury, medical malpractice, product liability, MDL, or mass tort firms can use to manage all aspects of their practice successfully and efficiently. Expert Institute, providing state-of-the-art expert witness location services and a whole host of other support services to help you with your expert part of your cases. And Hype Legal, full service digital marketing for trial lawyers. Check all of our sponsors out at our podcast website, elevate.fm. That's elawvate.fm, where you can go to our sponsorship page and find information for all of our sponsors.
Okay, we're back here with more of Lloyd Bell. So Lloyd, I wanted to ask you a question about medical malpractice. It happens to be what I spend most of my time doing too. But if you look at the data, the defense wins, you know, I think it may be changing a little bit, but by some statistics, 2/3 to 75-80% of the trials. A lot of lawyers don't want to take those cases. They can be really expensive. They can be really difficult. What do you think, what is it about your approach that's allowed you to have so much success in the medical malpractice field in particular?
Well, I'm familiar with those statistics that are thrown around. Usually they're thrown around by defense lawyers who are trying to sort of get you to take their lowball settlement. And I'm sure that the data is not too far off, that there are more defense victories, because it's just starting off, the defense has a lot of advantages. People, you know, tend to believe their doctors. They want to believe the healthcare system is generally safe. So there's some certain biases starting off. But I also think a lot of the reasons plaintiffs don't always get the results they want is the wrong kind of framework of approaching these cases. I talk a lot about medical malpractice cases at seminars around the country and different trial lawyers groups mostly. And the point I always make is that medical malpractice cases are not about medicine. And I think a lot of trial lawyers get seduced by the medicine because it's interesting. And we tend to get into the medical books and we learn how to use the language and understand the processes. And we sort of get seduced by the medicine and we bring that affection to trial, and I think we're impressing the jury with our medical knowledge. It's a big mistake. Juries, number one, aren't that impressed with a lawyer who can spout off a bunch of medicine, and it's also confusing. So one of the reasons I think these cases are problematic for a lot of folks is because they embrace the medicine too much, because these cases, and I'm convinced of this, are not about the medicine. The cases are about the human stories that exist between two people in different positions of power. You've got a patient in the most vulnerable position they can possibly be in. You know, a lot of times they're sitting on an exam table with their rear end hanging out of a gown in a cold room, completely vulnerable to the environment. And then you have the doctor, you know, nurses, you have clinicians, experts, all these professionals. So there's a real power disparity. But the cases are one where you can find the human stories that exist in those facts. And what I mean by human stories is the human failings. You know, where was the betrayal? Jerry Spence talks a lot about looking for the betrayal, and I think that's right. One thing I like to get lawyers to think about is looking for one of the seven deadly sins, one or more of the seven deadly sins in your bucket of facts. Do you have a moral failing? Do you have sloth? Do you have greed? Do you have pride? You know, what are those universal truths? We talked about universal truths. What are those universal, quote, sins that can lead to a bad patient outcome and lead to bad care? And in a lot of our cases, we'll find pride as a factor where, you know, one doctor won't listen to a nurse, you know, because it's a nurse and I don't listen to nurses, you know, for example. Or you might have sloth. An example of that is a doctor not coming in on the weekend to see a patient who needs to be seen and has some particular condition that requires the doctor to come in and evaluate the patient. So when you can align your case with a moral dimension, Rick Friedman calls it the moral core of the case. And I've always held on to that because I think it's so brilliant. You find the moral core of your case and the failings of the defense, and you present that to the jury in a way that's accessible. Yeah, they need to know the medicine. Yes, you've got to teach the basic medical elements so they understand what happened. But more importantly, the why the bad thing happened, not the what, but the why lives in that moral dimension. And the why can almost always be traced to some moral failing, not just necessarily by the individual clinician, but more often than not, the moral failing is at the system level, the administration level, where they have not put in the proper systems to keep patients safe, such as training, proper policies and procedures, teaching policies and procedures, all those things to keep patients safe. So that's a lot. That's a long answer to your question. But I do think the statistics would be better in favor of plaintiffs' verdicts as more plaintiffs try their case, but try it with an eye towards exposing the moral failing that led to the outcome.
Just, Lloyd, I had the privilege of coming to an Inner Circle meeting back in Nevada a couple of years ago, and I got to watch you do an opening statement on a misdiagnosis case you tried probably a little time before that. And what I noticed about your presentation skills, which I really appreciate, I'm really into the technology and utilizing it in an effective way, if possible. But your presentation and the technology that you used made it such a teaching moment for me. And it seemed like incredibly complicated stuff, but it never felt like that during your presentation. What's your take on the use of technology and the importance of multimedia in an opening statement, and why?
Well, anybody who knows me knows that I'm particularly passionate about the use of technology and all the tools that are available in the technology ecosystem we live in right now. I'm a huge fan of technology. And the reasons why are, there are several reasons. Number one, it works. It helps connect with the jury. It helps tell the story. It helps support and augment the moral truths of the story. So technology is tremendously helpful in doing that. And it also plugs into what we know about human nature and how we perceive information, how we process it, how we make decisions. And we're, at a very fundamental level, we're very visual creatures. I mean, nobody's advertising on billboards down the highway just by putting bullet points on a on a billboard. They're putting pictures in to elicit an emotional response. So we know these, that's how people are, that we're visual creatures. We also know that people across all generations now understand how to use smartphones, smart devices, how to absorb and process data they get from devices. So we're all, even you know, folks who later generations or very young people, everybody is familiar with technology now. At least all of our jurors are. At least to sort of my question of, you know, why wouldn't we use that familiarity in our trials to persuade and to teach? And there are different schools of thought. You know, we talk, Ben and I in the inner circle know a number of just tremendous lawyers who are more of the so-called old school, where they believe that the technology and the, you know, the multimedia experience can interfere with the relationship between the lawyer and the juror. Other people, and myself included, think that's true. It can interfere if it's not done correctly. But more often, if you do it correctly and you prepare your exhibits and the technology and use it in such a way that it supports and augments your presentation, it does a couple of things. It builds your credibility. It distinguishes your capabilities from the defense, which also goes to your credibility. It teaches the jury in medical cases, which I do mostly. It teaches the medicine in a way that's accessible. And that is critically important, because if a jury is going to be asked to reach a strong verdict against a healthcare professional, they're going to need to understand the basic medicine so that they feel like they're in a position to judge the conduct. So the technology helps in all those respects. And there's, I talk a lot about the use of trial tech. There are a lot of different areas to discuss, but on a very broad level, I would say that using pictures, models, if we can connect with all the different senses of the jury, not just speaking to them in just the words, the spoken word, which study after study after study shows is not the most effective way to reach people. But we use pictures, we use videos, we use models. I use physical demonstration. I used to do a lot of premises and fall down cases, and I would always reenact the fall and fall on the jury, on the courtroom floor in front of the jury, so that they could really appreciate and see what happened and appreciate why it could cause so much damage. I've fallen off of the witness stand before to demonstrate a syncopal or a blackout episode. So your body is a very powerful model as well, or a very powerful demonstrative. So all of these tools, the goal, of course, is persuasion and connection. And technology, I'm just a tremendous advocate for it, because I've seen how well it works, especially with today's modern jury.
So perhaps for lawyers who are not as comfortable with the technology, or for newer lawyers that are just getting started trying cases, could you kind of maybe give us a primer on where you go to learn more? What are some good resources? What do you recommend sort of as a technology platform?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I mean, I've been using, you know, Apple products for probably 15 years now. So I'm a big believer in them. I do, full disclosure, I do have some Apple stock, but that's not why I use them. I use them because their tools are very user-friendly. It's a closed kind of an ecosystem. So your iPhone works with your laptop, works with your desktop. It's very intentional ecosystem and very easy to work with. So the products, though, that I use primarily, Keynote, which is Apple's equivalent to PowerPoint, just an excellent program. It comes standard with any Apple product you buy, including iPhones and iPads. But the desktop version is the best one to work on, because you need some real estate on your screen to work effectively. But Keynote is a big one. That's where I create slides. A lot of times I'll blow up a slide and put it on a board and have a physical board, but they're all created primarily from Keynote. That's another one. There are a number of products I use to display evidence during trial, such as TrialPad. That's my favorite, and that's a very effective tool. So this is the internet age. So any of these products, you can go to YouTube and get training videos. You can go to the actual developer sites. A lot of times they have training videos for like TrialPad. So those are two of the the big sort of pieces of technology I use, but they're only, it's like a sort of metaphorical chalkboard. I mean, it gives you a surface to create. And what I like so much about Keynote is it allows you to drag in videos and pictures. It allows for special effects and interesting transitions, but you can also go a little nuts if you don't have any guidance, because there are almost too many options. So I've seen plenty of PowerPoint and Keynote presentations that are just full of bullet points and text, and God forbid lawyers will copy a page from an opinion and stick the whole page up on the screen and show it to a judge or show it to the jury. I mean, there's some really bad ways to use this technology that can be interfering. So you need to really study the materials out there to use it effectively. And you asked me the sources. One of my favorite books that deals with how to prepare beautiful, persuasive slides, whether it's PowerPoint or Keynote, is a book called Presentation Zen by Gar Reynolds. And he's just an incredible author and speaker. There are a lot of YouTube videos that he's put out. I believe he lives in Japan. He's got a very Zen approach of balance. He understands and can teach and does teach in his book the concepts of color, contrast, texture, these sort of design principles that are familiar to people like interior designers or website designers, but they apply directly in what we do as well in preparing our slides. He has very specific rules in preparing a slide deck, such as only use 6 words per slide, which is a rule that's always violated by people in my experience. 1 picture per slide, 1 concept per slide. And he's got many others. What colors to use with which backgrounds. I mean, a lot of times I'll see somebody have a blue background and a light or white text where everything just sort of melts away and you can't see anything. I mean, there are a lot of just practical lessons you can learn from that book. He's written others too, but that's the one that I use mostly. So bottom line, I'm really a believer in technology. Obviously, it can be intimidating because there's just so much out there. And where do you start? And I would just say you start where you start. Start with a product like Keynote and just play with it, experiment with it. Pull in a medical record, practice doing call-outs and highlights and zoom-ins and all those types of things you might want to show it to a jury. And you'll just gradually, like learning a foreign language, you start building your inventory of knowledge to where you can prepare slides very quickly, even during trial. During the evening, you're preparing for the next day, we'll be preparing slides for use. So, but you got to take the first step and start using it. And I would encourage everybody listening to do that.
I've heard you talk about structuring your opening, like thinking about it like a screenplay. Can you tell us a little bit about how you think about it that way?
Yeah, I call it my Stranger Things approach, referencing one of my favorite shows on Netflix called Stranger Things. But the basic concept is this, that in almost all of these shows that are so popular and that we love so much, another one, Breaking Bad, comes to mind, and just on and on, Downton Abbey, you name it. There's a basic structure which is very appealing that I've begun to adopt in my trial practice, particularly in opening statements. And the structure goes basically like this. The very first scene in any of these shows, Breaking Bad or Stranger Things, the very first scene is always a gripping point in time where the jury, the audience is like, what in the world is going on? It just pulls you in visually. If you remember Stranger Things, there's a scientist running down a hallway in some government building with a monster chasing him. You can't see the monster, and you're wondering what in the world's going on. And then he gets killed. You don't see him get killed, but he gets killed, fade away. And then all of a sudden the next scene is with the sheriff waking up in the morning and life is just normal. So you're left with this sort of burning image of this dramatic event. Like, hold on a second. How in the world are we going to get from here to there? It's that same concept I try to bring to opening statements. So the opening scene, instead of the traditional way of doing opening, you stand up and, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here. This is a case about blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I've jettisoned all of that. And now, more often than not, my opening is what I'll do is get up in front of the jury and not say a word. And I'll have my TV beside me. I use a widescreen, 55-inch flat screen TV, and I'll just fade in to a jarring moment in the case. And it might be my client on a treadmill, you know, trying to learn how to use their legs again after they've been paralyzed. Or it might be my client in bed with tubes coming out of every place you can think of after they've been, you know, horribly damaged because of negligence. But whatever that scene is, where the jury sees it and can never unsee it because of its dramatic, gripping nature, has to be obviously true. It has to be, can't be gratuitous. But and I usually try to show a scene of hope of somebody who's trying to, you know, who's working to overcome a disability, for example. But that first scene is the monster scene. It's you know, the monster running down the hallway, the gripping scene. And then I'll play that. It might be 30 seconds, it might be a minute. I won't give any commentary. And then I'll let that scene fade out from view and I won't comment about it. Jury's seen it. They don't need my input at that point. And then the next place I'll go is to discuss the medicine. And I might start off and talk about how many, you know, millions of people have a stroke every year. That's a stroke case. And then I'll discuss what a stroke is. And I'll start doing a multimedia. I don't really call it a multimedia. I might start using my slide deck to teach the medicine of stroke. So phase two is sort of the medicine phase, where teaching, and there's no advocacy, there's no overt advocacy. And I'm not trying to tell them to think anything. I'm just discussing how the body works in a very fundamental way and how the medical issues that they're going to hear in the case. Once I get done with the medical piece, I'll say, so what happened? You know, what's the story of this case? To quote David Ball, one of the great trial consultants, what's the story of this case? Well, come with me back to this date, this time. We are here. And then I just storytelling technique, tell the story, present tense. I generally focus on the conduct of the defendant, almost always the conduct of the defendant, because that's where the story will begin for me. And the jury will start judging the conduct of the defense very quickly, which is good advocacy. And then after I finish through the story of the case, there'll be a phase where I'll address the defenses and try and defang the defense, so to speak, the defenses, and address the two or three points that I know the defense is going to come with. And then I'll transition, talk briefly about the damages, but not too much about the damages. I don't want, at this phase, I want the jury to hear enough and to see enough to realize that this is a catastrophic injury, but I don't want to oversell it at that point. And I keep my tone steady. I don't start beating my chest or raising my voice or getting histrionic. And this is a teaching moment in my mind. And when I sit down, you know, my goal is for the jury to be 100% convinced I'm right. My goal is to, you know, the jury to have seen enough to reach the conclusions that we're right. And it's going to take a whole lot for the defense to push them back into believing that, you know, that their defense is correct. So that's kind of my, I know it's kind of a lengthy answer, but that's sort of how I approach opening statement.
Where do the themes you talked about before, the seven deadly sins, or the kind of universal themes that you're weaving through the medicine, come in? And do you have a rule-based approach where you talk about, you know, medical safety rules, or is that something you don't do?
No, I do. I incorporate it. I don't typically start off announcing what the rule is. What I'll do is I'll bake the rules into my discussion of the medicine. So if I'm talking about, for example, I do a lot of stroke cases. Patient has a stroke and they're within the window to receive what's called TPA, which is a clot buster, a chemical clot buster, or a thrombectomy, which is a mechanical thing that pulls the clot out. They're within that window through a whole bunch of bad decisions or whatever the reason, they don't get the treatment that they need and they end up with a catastrophic outcome. So when I'm teaching the medicine in that case, I teach it, I'm not going to say I dumb it down, but I teach it at a very basic level. And I'll have a bottle of liquid Drano there, for example, and I'll pull it up and I'll say TPA is medicine like liquid Drano. You pour it in the sink, it dissolves the clot, and it restores the flow of water in your sink, just like, you know, TPA will restore the flow of blood in your vessels. I'll pick up a, when I talk about thrombectomy, you know, that's a little different. It's like the snake you use in your bathroom. You can't, TPA won't dissolve it. You got to stick a snake in there and pull that hair clot out. Same thing doctors do. They have a little tube, little device they stick up. And so within that context, I'll say, you know, and the science, the scientists and the medical people have done all these studies and they've learned that you have to give TPA within a certain amount of time so it works. So the patient shows up and they're within, and with a stroke and they have been in their last known well, last time they were known to be normal was within 4.5 hours, you got to give them TPA. And that's a, I may call it a rule, I may not, but you know, you have to give TPA and that's what the standard of care is. So that's how I do it. I know a lot of folks really advocate a explicit, you know, there are three rules, 1, 2, 3. And I used to do that. And sometimes, I mean, I'm not saying I would never do that, but my impression now is that jurors just don't want you telling them and asking them to accept at face value, whatever proclamation the lawyer says. If they hear what a rule is after they understand the logic of why the rule exists, they're more likely to accept that rule. If you explain to them, this is the rule, they're less likely to accept that than if you explain the medicine and then get to the rule. And they're like, well, yeah, that rule makes sense now because, you know, if you wait 5 hours, 6 hours, it's not going to do them any good. And that's not, you know, you don't want to wait when a person's having a stroke. So that's how I approach it, Ben. You know, this is one of those areas where a lot of great lawyers may disagree, but this is an approach that works, that I believe works well.
Well, I've got to say, I while we were doing this podcast, I already ordered Presentation Zen. So, so thanks for that. I'm a huge fan, Lloyd, of Keynote, and am a huge promoter of it, just like you, and TrialPad, Beyond Bullet Points. But Presentation Zen, this is why I love this podcast. I always learn something new, and I learned something new from you, a lot of things, actually. I think the next trial I do, I'm going to try your style of opening statement. I've never done that before. And part of the reason is I always get a little bit concerned about putting the damages first and have always had this philosophy of earning the right to talk about damages by getting through the liability presentation. But the way that you do it, it doesn't seem like pandering at all. It seems very contextual, and that's awesome. So thank you for that.
Yeah, Raul, I appreciate that. I'm interested to get your feedback of how you feel like it goes when you put that in practice.
So on a scale of 1 to 10, I'm going to ask this of both of you, since I'm a PC guy, how important is it that I switch from PowerPoint to Keynote? Because I just turned 50 3 days ago, and you know, these things are harder to do.
It's all downhill
as you age. So, and I imagine there's some folks listening who also do PowerPoint, but you know, I'm willing to make a change if it's that important. So, scale of 1 to 10, where do you put it?
Okay, a scale of 1 to 10 in importance, 10 being like critically important. Yeah, I'd probably put it at 3 or 4, frankly. I mean, PowerPoint is a powerful tool. It gives you basically the same functionality. It's just a different language. And there's just a few things that feel different. I mean, I like the Apple interface, but the universal, we keep talking about universal truths in the rules that Raul's going to see in Presentation Zen, they translate to PowerPoint and Keynote. I mean, don't use bullet points. Or if you use them, just use 3 of them in a very limited way. But then maybe have a visual anchor on the same slide, but don't fill up slides with bullet points. Don't put extraneous garbage on the slide like your firm logo or unnecessary swooshes and color gradients. All those things are distractions. I usually start with a clean slate, a simple white slide, and then I'll build it out from there. So I don't think it's as important, Ben, if you're comfortable with PC products. I don't think you need to, you know, throw all that out and start, you know, head down to the Apple store and you know, $50,000 later, you've got all new equipment. But I think PowerPoint can be used well. Now, Cliff Atkinson is, not to keep plugging everybody's book, but he's written a great book called Beyond Bullet Points. And our fellow Inner Circle member, Mark Lanier, has embraced Cliff's concepts in that book to great effect with some amazing verdicts and all types of different cases. So, you know, it, obviously it can, if used well, it's another tool, but like any tool, you can use it poorly and really goof things up too.
Yeah. I would just punt on answering your question, Ben, until I see some of your slides, and it may be zero, it may be 12 on the scale. So,
okay, I'll send that over.
I have a feeling I'm going to agree with Lloyd totally on that.
So I just want to, we're just about done, but Lloyd, if our listeners want to hear more from you, I know you have your own podcast where you really focus on some of the patient safety issues relating to medical malpractice. Can you tell our listeners how to find you?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I mean, I was joking with you, Ben, about this, that, you know, what do trial lawyers do during COVID when all the courthouses are shut down and we have too much time on our hands? And apparently the answer is we start podcasts, because you've got a great one. There's some other friends of mine, Trial Lawyer Nation's another good one.
I should say Michael Cowan from Trial Lawyer Nation will be on in just a couple of weeks. So.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Well, we're going to learn more about how you build out an exceptionally successful podcast from Michael.
Well, he's definitely done that, and he's got a great podcast, just like you do. But my podcast is less focused specifically on trial lawyers, and I've deliberately tried to make it more, I guess, public facing is what people say. But it's called Face the Jury, and it's on all the major platforms, Apple, Spotify, all the other ones. But the podcast is a collection of stories, and my theme, or my motivation, I should say, in doing it is to try to educate the public about all the bad things that can happen. Now, people read about this stuff in the newspaper from time to time, or headline might catch their attention, but there are not that many outlets where folks will go into depth about the effects of medical malpractice. One of my specific goals is to help people identify what it is so that they can avoid it for themselves, their family, their loved ones. And when they go, and everybody's going to interact with the healthcare system at some point, no matter what. So this helps people understand what questions to ask, what to be mindful of, what are some of the red flags, what are some of the language that clinicians might use that can indicate something's wrong. So I'm really hopeful that my podcast will help sort of empower people and give them confidence to ask good questions when they're in the hospital and hopefully never become a client. That's the goal.
All right. So check out Face the Jury with Lloyd Bell, available on Apple iTunes and Spotify. Lloyd, thank you so much for coming on the show. You were terrific.
Well, thanks for having me, Ben and Raul. This has been a lot of fun, and good luck with your podcast and keep up the good work.
You too. Thanks.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.